The following message is brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity and was recorded at Westminster Chapel in Toronto. To learn more about the Ezra Institute's mission to advance the Lordship of Christ, please visit www.ezrainstitute.ca.
The scripture reading today is from Psalm chapter 63. Psalms chapter 63. Please stand as we read the word of the Lord. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. But those who seek to destroy my life shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult, for the mouths of liars will be stopped. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. This morning we're continuing our series in the Psalms, our summer in the Psalms. Last week we found ourselves under God's protective wings in Psalm 91. And I thought that was such a happy place to be, that was such a good place to be. Let's go there again this week. So Psalm 63, we've just heard that, verse 7, in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. And I'm mindful of the fact that it is a bit hot and stuffy under those wings, but it's a good place to be. We're under God's wings again. And this is a psalm of trust. Psalm 63 is a song of trust and confidence. Confidence in God's steadfast love. My soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. It's a song of trust and confidence. Charles Spurgeon said this about this psalm, Psalm 63. I know of no time and no season in which this psalm would sound unsuitably from a believer's mouth. And we learn that it was the practice of the early church to sing this song every day. One of the church fathers, John Chrysostom, tells us that every day this song was sang publicly in the church. So this is a song, in a sense, for all seasons, a song for all times, all seasons, but in particular, it's a song for seasons of drought. Seasons for when you find yourself in a dry and weary land. And this is how David begins, my soul thirsts, my flesh faints, as in a dry and weary land. And actually, this is a lament psalm. It's actually a lament psalm because it begins with that single letter there, O. O God. And that O there is a literary marker. It tells us this is a song of lament, a song of lament. O God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you. So it's a song of lament, but notice how quickly the psalm shifts. There's an immediate transition there. Yes, David laments and cries out, my soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you. But very quickly, David's in the sanctuary. Very quickly, David says, my soul will be satisfied. And then at the end, my soul clings to you. And yes, we have the cry of lament at the beginning, but then throughout the psalm after that, David is singing. He's singing God's praises. He's singing for joy. So this is a psalm that takes us very quickly from lament, from crying out to God, very quickly to the promise, my soul will be satisfied. I will sing for joy. Very quickly to my soul clings to God. So the psalm sets out a path for us. We start off hungering and thirsting, but very quickly, there's a rapid journey right to praise, to joy. to comfort, to the security of God's wings, to his right hand. But before we take that journey, I think it's important that we start right at the beginning there. And you'll notice that the psalm has a heading. This is called a superscription. We read that this is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judea. And this is actually part of the psalm itself. It gives us the historical context of the psalm, but it belongs to Scripture. This isn't something that the translator or the editor of the ESV added in there. It's part of verse 1. It's part of God's word. So we're told that this is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judea. So we can't jump over this. We need to stop there first and appreciate the historical context of the psalm. So however lofty the poetry is of all the psalms, and of this psalm in particular, the psalms are always grounded in history. They're always grounded in the experience of God's people. I think this is why they resonate so well with us, because they're grounded in the experience of God's people, and that's our own experience. And so we read them and we find them giving voice, articulating our praise, articulating our prayers, our laments. So this is a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judea. This isn't a psalm that David wrote when he was lounging in his palace one Sunday afternoon. This is a psalm that David wrote in the wilderness of Judea. It's a psalm he wrote in the watches of the night, lying upon his bed in the watches of the night. This is the setting, the context for the psalm. And we know that this period in the wilderness of Judea was during a period when David had been king, but there was a revolt in the kingdom, led by his son, Absalom. And David had to flee the capital. He had to flee Jerusalem, and he was hiding out in the wilderness. This comes from late in David's life. So we have three basic periods in his life. The first is that long period of time where he waits to sit on the throne of Israel. So he's anointed very early as a teenager, but he waits for years and years, and he's chased by Saul in the wilderness there. We have that period of his life. And we see that in 1 Samuel 16 to 2 Samuel chapter 1, this period before he becomes the king. Then we have the second period of David's life. This is 2 Samuel chapter 2 to 10. This is a period of blessing, a period of prosperity. David is ruling over Israel, and Israel is prospering. But then we have 2 Samuel chapter 11. And this is a major turning point. And this is the beginning of the third part of David's life. And it's the part of David's life where the prophet Nathan says, "The sword will be upon your house." And this psalm comes from that period in David's life. And I think most of us are familiar with 2 Samuel 11. This is the account of the sin with Bathsheba. Bathsheba was one of David's closest friend's daughter, Eliam, and one of David's closest friend's husband, Uriah the Hittite. And while Eliam and Uriah and the men of Israel are off fighting in war, David doesn't go with them. He stays in Jerusalem, and he takes Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. And then when he discovers that she's become pregnant, he hatches a conspiracy. He calls Uriah back to Jerusalem because he wants Uriah to go home to his wife. So the pregnancy looks like it's his child, not David's child. But Uriah is a man of integrity. And whatever David does to get him to go home, Uriah won't do it. And he says to David, "The ark of God and the men of Israel are sleeping in tents. The ark of God is resting in a tent on the battlefield. How can I go home and lie with my wife?" And of course, this is a rebuke to David because he should have been with the men. He should have been with the ark in the battlefield. So what does David do? He plans Uriah's death. He makes an official decree, a notice to the general, put Uriah on the front lines, and then call the troops back. So Uriah is killed in battle. And he puts that official decree in Uriah's own hand and tells Uriah to go to the battlefield. So there's Uriah, this man of integrity, of righteousness, a convert to the faith of Israel, and he has to travel all those days back to the battlefield with his own death sentence in his hand. And this is the turning point in David's reign. This is the turning point in David's life. He'd taken his neighbor's wife and then killed his neighbor. These are two sins for which there's no sacrifice. There's no sacrifice for this. All there is for David is the death penalty. And when the prophet Nathan confronts him, David knows this. He knows, I'm a dead man. I deserve death. All he can do is throw himself before God and plead with God for God's mercy. And this is the historical context, the setting for Psalm 51, and it's a psalm that we all know. Listen again to the superscription. Psalm 51, to the choir master, a psalm of David. When Nathan the prophet went to him after he had gone into Bathsheba, and David begins, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." David pleaded before God according to God's steadfast love. He pleaded with God for mercy according to God's steadfast love, and God had mercy on him. David would keep his life, but the prophet warns him. The prophet declares, "The sword will never leave your house." And in the chapters after that, what we see is David's own sons following him in his sin. So his one son, Amnon, takes his half-sister, just as David had taken Bathsheba. His other son, Absalom, when he sees this, is enraged and hatches a plot to kill Absalom. He follows David in the plot to commit murder. So we see the sin of David being imitated, carried out by his sons. And then Absalom, shortly after that, leads a rebellion against David. So what he does is he starts hanging out around the gates of Jerusalem there. The people are always coming and going there, the people of Israel. And he sits there as a judge, and over time he wins the favor of the people. He's out there talking, rubbing elbows, giving favorable verdicts in his judgments, and the people grow to love Absalom. And then Absalom hatches a plot to overthrow his father. And by this time, he has such support from the people that all of Israel is against David. So David has to flee the capital. He flees Jerusalem. It's a very moving account. He goes down over the Kidron Brook there, up the Mount of Olives. He prays. The priests take the ark with them, and David says, "No, leave the ark here in Jerusalem. If God has favor on me, I'll be back. I'll worship again in the presence of the ark." And then he goes off across the Jordan, and he hides there in the wilderness of Judea. And the whole nation is against him. And we have two psalms from this period. Two psalms when he was hiding from Absalom and hiding from the armies of Israel. Psalm 3 and our psalm today, Psalm 63. But listen to how Psalm 3 begins. "O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising up against me. Indeed, the whole nation is against him. Many are saying of my soul, 'There is no salvation for him in God.' But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head." This is the context in which David is praying to God. He writes Psalm 3, and he writes Psalm 63. He's hiding in the wilderness. The whole nation is out to get him. Absalom is leading this revolt against him. And he lays down his head at night to sleep, and he prays this psalm, Psalm 63. And I think it's amazing the focus of David's prayer here. Given the historical context, given what he's experiencing right now, listen to where his thoughts are. He prays, "O God, my soul thirsts for you." He doesn't say, "My soul thirsts for water." He says, "My soul thirsts for you." He doesn't say, "Oh God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for the blood of my enemies." He doesn't say, "Oh God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for deliverance from this situation." He doesn't say, "Oh God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for the restoration to my throne, to the restoration of your kingdom." He says, "Oh God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you. Earnestly I seek you." David has a focused, exclusive, eager, singular desire for God alone. That's all he's thinking about. His thoughts are entirely directed towards heaven. And I think it's this singular focus, it's the intensity and the focus of this prayer that immediately takes him to the sanctuary. So we're told right away, yes, okay, as in a dry and weary land, but right away in verse 2, "I have looked upon you in your sanctuary." So David immediately is transported in his prayer from the wilderness, from this predicament that he finds himself in, right to the sanctuary. And now in the sanctuary, David had worshiped God in the past. He had been there in the presence of the ark. He had beheld, he had seen the glory, the power of God. And as he lies down his head there in this wilderness, again he experiences God's power. Again he experiences God's power, his glory. He's in the sanctuary once again. And as he's meditating upon this, as he finds himself spiritually in God's sanctuary, there's one attribute of God that jumps out. And there's one attribute of God that he turns his attention to, and that's God's steadfast love. Look at verse 3. God's steadfast love. There's a Hebrew word for this, steadfast love. It's hesed. Hesed. God's steadfast love. In different translations, it's sometimes translated compassion or mercy. In the King James, it's often translated as loving kindness. And the ESV usually translates it as steadfast love. Steadfast love. And this is a good translation for it because it's not just love. This is a loyal love, a faithful love, a persevering and enduring love. This is a love that is faithful to covenant. God has made a covenant with Israel. He made a covenant with Abraham. He made a covenant with David. And God's love is faithful to that covenant. So this is a loyal love, a loyal, faithful, enduring love. It's the love between a husband and a wife. It's a love between God and his people. This is hesed. It's hesed. And in the Old Testament, where God's hesed is demonstrated most clearly and revealed is actually in Exodus chapter 32. So in Exodus chapter 32, we have Israel and its rebellion, Israel and its great sin, forging that golden calf at the base of Mount Sinai, Aaron and the priests leading the way there. And when God discovers this and Moses comes down the mountain, God wants to destroy Israel. Israel is a rebellious and sinful people. Listen to what Psalm 78 says about Israel. These are verses 56 and 57. Yet they tested and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned away and acted treacherously like their fathers. They twisted like a deceitful bow. They twisted like a deceitful bow. This is an image of sinful humanity, a twisted, deceitful bow. It's a bow where the archer, when he picks it up, he lays his arrow on that bow, he pulls the string back, and he aims at his target, but he always misses the target because there's a flaw in the grain of the bow. The bow is twisted. It's a deceitful bow. This is the picture of sinful humanity. This is the picture of Israel at the base of Mount Sinai. A twisted bow, and God wanted to throw the twisted bow in the fire. But Moses interceded. Moses interceded on behalf of the people, and God had mercy on them, and then revealed himself to Moses. And we read about this in Exodus 34, and this is how God reveals himself, precisely at the moment where Israel sins against him and rebels against him. Exodus 34, 5 and 6. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with Moses there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Right there in the heart of the Exodus story, precisely at the moment where Israel rebels against God, God reveals himself as a God who's merciful, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. This is hesed. This is hesed. God is a God of hesed. David knew this hesed. David had his own golden calf moment, Bathsheba and Uriah. David knew God's grace. He knew God's mercy. He knew God's steadfast love, his hesed. David himself was a twisted bow, a deceitful bow, but God had mercy on him. And this is why the Psalms again and again celebrate God's steadfast love, God's hesed. It's one of the enduring themes of the Psalms, God's hesed, God's steadfast love. And it's a word that is illustrated by the stork of all things, the stork, the bird. The Hebrew word for stork is hasidah, just like hesed, hasidah, stork. And the stork is an illustration of God's hesed. The hasidah illustrates God's hesed, illustrates God's loving kindness. Listen to what we read in Job. This is where God is speaking to Job. Job 36. The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, but they cannot compare with the pinions and the feathers of the stork, the hasidah. The ostrich lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them or that some wild animal may trample upon them. She treats her young harshly, as if they were not hers. Well, that's the ostrich. But God is not like an ostrich. He's like the stork, the hasidah. When the Hebrews watched the stork, they saw there an illustration of God's hesed, his steadfast love. So they called it hasidah. And the stork builds its nest way up in a tree. And if you just do a Google image search, stork nests, you can see these things. They're massive. And they've actually found stork's nests that are 6 feet wide and 9 feet deep. Massive nests, way up high. And the stork is monogamous, faithful to a single partner for life, and the stork keeps its nest up there. So this is a permanent, secure, safe nest. God is like the stork. He's not like the ostrich who just buries its eggs in the sand and walks away, and they may be all right, they may not. God places us in a nest, a fortress nest, way up high, out of harm's way. And he stays with his young. He cares for his young. This is the stork, the hasidah. And this is God, God's hesed. So David, as he's meditating upon God's steadfast love, he imagines himself under the wings of the bird in this fortress nest, safe and secure. The darkness of the night, the darkness of the wilderness, turns into a sanctuary. It turns into the shadow of God's wings. The people of God, the people of Israel, knew God's hesed. They had experienced God's steadfast love. This is one of the reasons we have the Psalms to begin with. The Psalms are the celebration of God's steadfast love. The Psalms were composed as Israel's hymn book to celebrate God. And we read about the origins of this singing in the temple in 1 Chronicles 16. 1 Chronicles 16, this is the account where David brings the ark into Jerusalem, and there's all the sacrifices there and the festivities, and he blesses the people of Israel with a hymn on that occasion. And the concluding line of that hymn is this: give thanks to the Lord, for his steadfast love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord, for his hesed endures forever. This is the hymn that David sung. And then at the end of the hymn, when it concludes, David appoints priests to do various acts of worship in the temple there, in the tabernacle, the sanctuary. And the last group that he mentions are musicians. Listen to this. 1 Chronicles 16:41 and 42. With them, with these other priests that were set to do various tasks, were Heman and Jeduthun, and the rest of those chosen and expressly named for a single purpose, to give thanks to the Lord. Why? For his steadfast love endures forever. Verse 42, Heman and Jeduthun had trumpets and cymbals for the music and instruments for sacred song. David appointed priestly musicians in the temple to give thanks to God in song continually. Why? Because God's steadfast love is continuous. It endures forever. So when you went to the temple in Jerusalem, you heard singing. And it was singing that was praising God for his steadfast love. Then we shouldn't be surprised what we read in Psalm 63. Look at verses 3 and 4. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. I will bless you as long as I live. In your name, I will lift up my hands. David's cry of lament in the wilderness has turned into a song of praise, a song of joy in the sanctuary, under the shadow of God's wings. Yes, he was in the wilderness of Judea. Yes, the whole nation had turned against him. Yes, his own son had rebelled. But David, lying on his bed, is meditating upon God. He finds himself in the sanctuary. He recognizes that the darkness of that time is actually the shadow of God's wings. And he's singing for joy. He's praising God. The lament, the O God, you are my God, turns into a song of praise and rejoicing. Then we have verse 5. And verse 5 is the answer to the cry of verse 1. David says, my soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you as in a dry and weary land. And then in verse 5, he confidently declares, my soul will be satisfied with as with fat and rich foods. David writes in another psalm, Psalm 34. This is again when he was in the wilderness being pursued by Saul. He writes this, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. David's been persecuted before. He's been in the wilderness before. And when he was in the wilderness before, God set before him a feast. In the valley of the shadow of death, God prepares a table. Psalm 23. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. David's in the wilderness again. He's in the darkness again. He's being pursued again. And again, God presents before him a feast. Taste and see that the Lord is good. And of course, as we think about this image of a feast, of food, we're also reminded of the temple. Because David smelled burning food there in the temple. He smelled rich and fat food that we read about here in verse 5. So not only would you hear the singing when you went to the temple, you would smell the sacrifices. Continually there was something burning on the altar. And we're told there that the fat was burning up. It was a sweet-smelling aroma rising up to God. It's just like when you're walking through your neighborhood or you're in your backyard and your neighbor is barbecuing something and it kind of wafts over there. Yeah, what's that about? You know, you're kind of drawn over there a bit. You can think of these cartoons where people are kind of floating past the scent. This is what you would have experienced in the temple, the smell of burning meat, of burning fat rising up to God. But the fat was for God alone. We're told this in all the prescriptions in Leviticus and elsewhere. The priest could eat some of the meat, but not the fat. The fat belongs to the Lord. The fat has to be burned up wholly on the altar, and the smell of it burning, rising up to God. But what do we read here? David is promised some of the fat. I think it actually says there, the fat in the marrow, the fat in the marrow. Megan and I had a nice lamb chop the other day, barbecued that up. And I got the piece with the bone, you know, cut off there. And inside is a little bit of marrow. And when Megan wasn't looking, I took my knife and just scooped that out. Delicious. The marrow, the fat in the marrow. This is the Lord's portion, the fat. And David says, I'm going to taste the fat. I'll get a taste of the fat. He declares this. This is his confidence. So he's hungering and thirsting for God, and God says, come. Come and eat with me. Get a taste of the fat. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich foods, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips. Well, this takes us now to verses 6 and 7. I've mentioned this already, but notice the time here, the location. David's on his bed. It's the watches of the night. It's nighttime. David is in bed. When I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. David is hiding in the wilderness. He lies down to go to sleep at night, and he's awake. Something's keeping him up, but it's not the anxiety of the situation. He's not worried about all of Israel. He's not worried that any moment Absalom's forces could descend on him and his small group of supporters there. He's not worried about waking up to the sound of the swords clashing. He's awake, yes, but he's awake because he's thinking about God. He's remembering God. He's meditating on God. It's this vision of the sanctuary that's keeping him up. He's not worried about the darkness out there. He knows that the darkness is just a shadow of God's wings. So he's kept up at night, but it's not for fear. It's not for anxiety. It's because he's remembering God. He's meditating upon God. Now, we've been talking about David in the wilderness of Judea, his experience. But I want to give an exhortation here. We can't just read through the psalm and think, well, great for David. Wonderful that David had this faith and this was his experience. Because this, yes, was David's prayer, but it's also our prayer. It needs to be our prayer. Psalm 63 was David's prayer, but it needs to be our prayer. It was David's experience, but it needs to be our experience. You can't pray this psalm and experience it secondhand. It has to be experienced firsthand. And notice what David says here. He remembers God. He meditates on him. For you have been my help, he says. You have been my help. He's thinking about his own experience. He's remembering his own experience. He doesn't say there in the psalm, for you have been Abraham's help. For you have been Joshua's help. For you have been Samuel's help. He's praying there and he's thinking about his own experience. You have been my help. And maybe this is just a temptation for me because I read church history and I get pretty excited about different people in the past. But it's easy to kind of spiritually live vicariously through other people. You think, oh, how awesome, Wilberforce and all this, great. Look at the Psalm of David, wonderful. Don't live vicariously through these others' experience. This has to be your experience. You have to make this your prayer. You have to pray with all honesty and integrity. You have been my help. Yes, you were David's help, but you have been my help. So there's an important word here. That's in verse 6, remember. Remember. This is part of Christian prayer, remembering. We have to remember. The great hymn writer, John Newton, emphasized this discipline, remembering. He was a man who remembered. When he prayed, he remembered. And he had a spiritual practice where once a week, once a month, and once a year, or a few times a year, he would set aside time to do precisely this, to remember. So once a week on Saturday evening, he would set aside time to review the week that had just passed, to remember his own sins and to remember God's mercy on him. And then once a month, it was the tradition at the time, like it is for us, to celebrate communion once a month. So the Saturday evening before communion, he would set aside time to remember. He would remember God. And in particular, he would meditate upon, he would remember the atonement, the demonstration of God's hesed, the demonstration of God's steadfast love on the cross. Augustine, in his comment on this, on verse 4, I think it is, where David says, I lift up my hands. In your name, I lift up my hands. Augustine explains, we as Christians lift up our hands when we pray because Christ lifted up his hands for us on the cross. It's a wonderful thought. Remember, Newton, on Saturday evening, would meditate, remember the cross, remember the atonement. And then at certain moments throughout the year, he would take time to remember what God had done for him. So on his birthday, wedding anniversary, New Year's Day, different moments like that, he would set aside time on that day and remember what God had done for him that far throughout his life up until that point. He used to tell people, my life is a theater of God's grace. So we practice the discipline of remembering. When we pray, we need to do as David did here. Remember. Remember God. Remember his steadfast love and his mercies. This is what John Newton did. He remembered. This is why he could write in that famous hymn, Amazing Grace, through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The Lord has promised good to me. His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures. Newton was a man who remembered, and this is why he could write such hymns. Well, I know for me personally, this weekend right now is a time for me to remember. It's a time for Megan and I to remember. This past Friday was our 10th wedding anniversary. So we've been married for 10 years. And this weekend, we've just taken time to remember what God has done for us, to think about his grace, to think about all of his mercy these past 10 years, and especially these last few years. There's been an outpouring of God's mercy on us, his grace on us. We're in a new house now, and it's been a total blessing to us. Some of you have been there. Hopefully all of you at some point will be there. You can see our backyard, my perfect grass cutting and everything else, Megan's gardening. Two children, Samuel and Leah. So it's been a time for us to look back and reflect and remember God has been our help. And we can declare, we've been singing about this today, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. There's a real challenge in that song. It comes from Lamentations 3, actually. His mercies are new every morning. You can think about that. Do you wake up in the morning looking for the new mercies? That's what Jeremiah says there. His mercies are new every morning. Every day there's new mercies. And actually, even in this psalm, Psalm 63, verse 1, where it says, earnestly I seek you, actually what it says there is, early in the morning I seek you. Early in the morning. So do you wake up early in the morning looking for God's new mercies? I know this is difficult for many of us. You kind of wake up in a bit of a fog. But try and direct your attention to that. God's mercy. God's mercy. David tells us, my soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. David's song of lament has turned into a song of praise and blessing. His thirsting has been satisfied. And so he sings for God, sings to God in joy. And then we read in verse 8, my soul clings to you. His soul was thirsty. There's the promise it will be satisfied. And now my soul clings to you. Your right hand upholds me. My soul clings to you. My soul holds fast to you. I think the King James says here, my soul will followeth hard after thee. My soul clings to you, holds fast to you. This word cling, it's the same word that we read in Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, where we read this, the man will leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, cling to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. It's the same word there, cling. And Paul tells us in Ephesians 5, that verse there in Genesis 2 is actually about Christ in the church. Christ clings to us. Christ holds fast to us. Christ clings to his bride, the church. This is what David is saying when he says, your right hand upholds me. Christ upholds us. Christ clings to us. David says, my soul clings to you because he knows your right hand upholds me. Now, what does it mean then for us to cling to God, to hold fast to God? Well, this word appears in many different passages in Deuteronomy, actually. I'll give you one verse in Deuteronomy which helps us understand what is this clinging. How do we cling to God? This is Deuteronomy 13, verse 4. You shall walk after God, after the Lord your God, and fear him, and keep his commandments, and obey his voice. And you shall serve him and cling to him. So what does it mean for us to cling to God? Well, it's not just a warm feeling of assurance. There's nothing wrong with a warm feeling of assurance. I felt in my own spirit, meditating on this psalm all week, a warm feeling of assurance building up in me. I'm grateful for that. That's okay. Celebrate that if you've got it. But there's more to clinging than just that feeling of assurance. To cling to God is to walk after God, to fear God, to obey God. This is what it means to cling to God, to keep his commandments and obey his voice. To cling to God, then, is to love God. To cling to God is to have hesed for God, steadfast love for God. God's hesed, his steadfast love for us, takes root in us, and we turn it back to him in clinging to him. His chesed is turned back towards him when we cling to him, our steadfast love for him. David experienced this. He clung to God because he had experienced God clinging to him. He had chesed for God because he had experienced God's chesed, his steadfast love for him. And notice what we read in the historical account then. This is the end of Absalom's rebellion. This is after David has prayed this psalm in the wilderness. 2 Samuel 19. When Absalom is defeated and the rebellion is put down, David is on his way back to Jerusalem. And on his way back to Jerusalem, he meets various people that had opposed him during the rebellion, that had cursed him and turned against him. And what does he do? He shows chesed on them. He pardons them. He has mercy on them. David knew God as a God of chesed, and he himself became a man of chesed, a man of mercy, grace, steadfast love, and faithfulness. And then in the very next chapter, we read this. No sooner has David come back to Jerusalem and things appear to have been restored, there's another rebellion, and the 10 northern tribes turn against him. But we read this. The men of Judah clung to their king. David is clinging to God, and in clinging to God, he's become a man of steadfast love. He's shown steadfast love to the men of Judah, and now they cling to him. They cling to him because he clings to God. He's a true king. He's a king that rules with chesed, with steadfast love and faithfulness. And so now his men turn to him, even those who had cursed him and turned against him. They now turn to him and cling to him. It's the same word there, cling. So David is a man clinging to God, and because he's a man clinging to God, other men cling to him. Other men cling to him. I think this is the calling of every Christian. We're called to be people like this, people of chesed, people who are clinging to God so that other people might cling to us. This psalm, Psalm 63, is a psalm of trust, a psalm of confidence. And we are a people who are growing and living in this trust, in the confidence of Psalm 63. And as such people, we become a people who are ourselves a source of confidence and trust. And so people come to us. Just as we cling to God, people can come to us and cling to us and find in us the trust, the confidence, the chesed of Psalm 63. Psalm 63, then, is training for mission, training for Christian witness. We become like the God we read about in Psalm 63, and then others start to cling to us, and they become such people, and people cling to them. David was a man who clung to God, and the men of Judah clung to him. The church are the people who are upheld by Christ, cling to him, so that others may cling to us. Listen to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians. This is how he opens the letter to the Corinthians. Verses 3 and 4 of chapter 1. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the Father of chesed, and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our afflictions for a purpose, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves have been comforted by God. David was a man who clung to God so others could cling to him. And each one of us in this church is called to be a church that clings to God so that others may cling to us. I don't know where you find yourself this morning. You may have come here in a place that looks a lot like a dry and weary land. Come here hungering and thirsting for God. But I want to say, because David says it in this psalm, and I know it from my own experience, don't mistake the darkness or the wilderness for God's absence. The darkness is the shadow of God's wings protecting us. And meditate upon this psalm this week. Come to know the confidence that David knew. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and marrow. Come to know the joy David's lips, even in this situation, probably a situation none of us will ever quite find ourselves in. Even so, in that situation, his eyes are directed towards heaven, a singular focus on God. And so he turns to God with songs of praise, even in the midst of such a situation. When David was in the valley of the shadow of death, the Lord prepared a table for him, and he ate with God there. You may have come here in your life right now. You find yourself in the valley of the shadow of death. But God prepares for us a table. He invites us to come and eat, taste and see that the Lord is good. And as we come to this communion table, let's listen to God's invitation. In Isaiah 55. God's invitation in Isaiah 55. And notice where it concludes, God's steadfast love for David. The steadfast love of Psalm 63. This is the prophet Isaiah. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no mercy, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. This is the invitation that God offers us this morning. So let's hear that invitation as we come to the communion table.
Thank you for listening to this message brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. Please feel free to share it with friends, but do not charge for or alter the material in any way without the express written consent of the EICC. Thank you.